This episode is brought to you by the Great Courses Plus. With over 8,500 different lectures on anything you can imagine, including history, science, language, even cooking and photography, there's probably a course for you. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/unplugged for a free 30-day trial. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. We're a few episodes into this podcast now, so I think I should get something out of the way. I'm a huge fan of The Lord of the Rings, and it's hard for me to resist Lord of the Rings references when I'm talking to guests or in the middle of an episode. Now, it could be a lot worse. I could also mention Star Trek, which I'm a fan of also. But thankfully, with this episode, I can mention Lord of the Rings because our guest does. Our guest is Father Dwight Longenecker. He is a Catholic priest in Greenville, South Carolina, and he's finished a fascinating new book. Here's how Lord of the Rings fits into it. He's doing a research project that is surrounded with myth, and he quotes the character Galadriel, who tells the story of the Ring of Power in The Lord of the Rings, and says, "History became legend, and legend became myth." And there are a lot of stories out there that have a kernel of historical truth but are surrounded by myth, most notably the legend of King Arthur. There's some documentation to suggest that a person around the collapse of the Roman Empire in England did exist, named Arturius, but of course the whole legend has been completely embellished. What Father Longenecker has done is looked into the three wise men, the story of the Magi that appear in the nativity story of Jesus that you can see in any Christmas pageant in America or the Christian world, songs like We Three Kings of Orient Are. Well, Father Longenecker knew that there are a lot of embellishments to the story. The Matthew account never mentions that there are three of them. He just says that they are wise men from the east who see a star and go to Jerusalem and wind up in Bethlehem. But there's been a lot of details added to the story over the centuries. Names are given to these three kings, Balthazar, Melchior, and Caspar, who come from Arabia, Africa, and India. But the thing is, the original story never says they come on camels, and there's not a suggestion that a star even leads them to Bethlehem. Furthermore, most biblical scholars would deconstruct the text and say that the three wise men don't even exist. It's just a later embellishment added to the story to give a prophetic coding to Jesus and to announce him as the Messiah. These would be scholars that would use a deconstructionist tradition that would typically throw out the supernatural. Well, what Father Longenecker has done is pretty fascinating. He's decided to look at what could be the historical reality of the Magi. Because they're really dismissed outright by scholars, they never bother to see if there's anything in there. What he's done is look at the history and look at the politics of the area of Judea in the first century and found that there very well could be a place where the so-called Magi could have come from, and it's not Persia. It's not the Orient, as the song goes, but Nabatea, this huge civilization that existed south of Judea and traded all throughout Arabia and the Near East. And these would have been people that would have traded with Mark Antony and Cleopatra, and also Herod, the king who tried to kill Jesus. And they built all sorts of structures, like in Petra, Jordan, and built this huge structure that you can see in movies like Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. So it gives a whole new different historical perspective to something that a lot of people consider just to be a myth. It's a super fascinating interview, and I'm going to jump right in after this long intro to my talk with Father Dwight Longenecker. Hey, Father Longenecker, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I want to ask you about something. You mentioned this when we were talking before we started recording, and you said that the Magi, in a way, they're like a mixture between Lord of the Rings and the legends of King Arthur, where in Lord of the Rings, by the way, I'm a huge Lord of the Rings nerd, so I'm tracking with this really closely, where Galadriel talks about the losing of the One Ring as history became myth, myth became legend. And then Arthur also, there are nuggets of history in there, but there's all this legend piled on. So how did that perspective frame your approach to the story of the Magi?
Oh, first of all, there was a little hiccup in what you said. She doesn't say history became myth and myth became legend. She says history becomes legend, legend becomes myth.
Okay, well, and hey, we're going to get Tolkien right on this show,
but
I take that well.
No,
yeah.
It's important because actually the legend is the history, which is still being told as history, but it's been embroidered. It's being exaggerated. It's being made a real special, but it's still treated as a historical thing which took place. By the time it becomes myth, there are more supernatural elements being added. The characters are even more distanced from any kind of historic rootedness in history, and the myth starts. They start almost becoming gods and goddesses, and all sorts of extra levels of meaning are added when you get to the level of myth. Supernatural meaning, spiritual meaning, moral meaning, theological meaning, all this sort of things added in and embroidered and laid on top of the basic history. And this is what we see happening with something like, well, my favorite is King Arthur, but you could also use the story of St. Nicholas and how he became Santa Claus, right, if you want. But also with King Arthur, you can actually go to England and visit some sites that historians think might have some roots in the Arthurian myth and legend. And you can go to Glastonbury. You can go to a hill fort in Somerset called the South Cadbury Hill Fort. You can go to Tintagel Castle down in Cornwall. And all of the links with history are very intriguing and fascinating. But of course, there's lots of legend and myth woven into it. And so what the archaeologist does is goes through and says, well, all the legend and myth is beautiful and wonderful and rich, but we're going to try to cut through all that and see if we can find what historical roots there would be to this story. And that's what I did with the Magi story.
Now let's start at the beginning, and you are a priest in South Carolina in Greenville, is that correct?
Yes. Okay,
Greenville. What interested you in the story of the Magi originally, and what made you want to investigate their historicity?
I do a lot of freelance writing for popular journals and magazines and websites, and around Christmas time, editors are always looking for some kind of a Christmas story. So someone asked me to write a story on where did the Magi come from. So I began looking into it for my article, and the typical pat response is, well, a lot of Bible scholars, first of all, believe that the whole Magi story is a pious fiction. They think that it doesn't have any root in history, and that it was a story added on much later, after the death of Jesus Christ, in order to make Jesus that much more special person. Some others believe the pat historical answer would be, if the Magi existed, they were Persian astrologers, Persian shamans, who saw signs in the star, signs in the night sky, and set off to Jerusalem to find this King of the Jews. So I looked a bit further and said, well, what if actually the Bible itself indicates where they come from? And there's prophecies in the Old Testament book of Isaiah that they came from Saba and Ephah. Well, when you look up these ancient countries, they're actually from Arabia. So I then went and said, well, who was in Arabia at the time of the birth of Christ around 6 BC? And the most predominant inhabitants of Arabia at that time is the Nabataean civilization. And the Nabataean civilization is very, it's amazing how important it was at that time period, but how little is known about it, and how little people in this day and age know about it. The main thing they know about the Nabataeans, of course, is the fantastic city in the desert of Jordan called Petra. And that was the capital of the Nabataean civilization.
Which I think, as you've heard a number of times, if they haven't heard of Petra, they would know that structure from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
That's right. In the third Indiana Jones movie, the climactic scene is set in the Great Treasury, the temple carved into a cliffside there in Petra.
So I suppose that's the entry point for the common man or the common woman to enter into a discussion of the Nabataeans.
Absolutely. That's the connecting point.
So I want to ask you a little more about kind of the discourse in biblical studies where scholars will look at what they interpret to be fictions that are added on later to make the story something it's not. Now, what would a Bible scholar, if they assumed the Magi to be a fiction, why would they think that they're added into the nativity story? Is it supposed, because they're from the East, it bestows some sort of, prophetic or messianic type of embellish to the nativity story? Or why would they, what would they say about that?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. First of all, there's one school of New Testament scholarship which basically goes through and tries to demythologize the New Testament. Now, this goes right back to German scholars at the turn of the century, people like Rudolf Bultmann, who said for the New Testament to stand up to modern criticism, we have to take out all of this what he called the mythological elements, the supernatural elements, you know, exorcisms and Jesus walking on the water and calming the storm. And so they came up with this idea that all these mythological elements were added in by Greek and Gnostic writers, probably about 80 or 90 years after the death of Jesus, or even later, and that these were just pious fictions that later writers wove it in because they wanted Jesus to be this son of God figure, this mythological Hercules type figure. It was influenced by paganism, and so they therefore view any kind of supernatural element with suspicion, and therefore the Magi story with a magical star that leads the wise men across the desert sands and pinpoints the birth of this God child, they would say no, this was added on later. this is make believe, okay? And so that's their motivation for saying that it's mythological. But there's also other things as well. The other strand is if a story seems to fulfill a biblical prophecy, they also have a bias against the idea that there could be such a thing as prophecy, which could foretell the future. There is a prophecy in the book of Numbers in the Old Testament about the prophet Balaam, and it says a star shall rise in Judah and so forth. And a lot of scholars have seen that prophecy and said, oh, Matthew is obviously making up this, or later writer is adding to Matthew's story this thing about a star that rose to fulfill Balaam's prophecy. And so there are these two strands, which mean that modern scholars will tend to view the story with suspicion. I've always viewed their views with suspicion, to tell you the truth, because I've always felt that while the story might have been embroidered in later years, that Matthew's actual account of the Magi is actually very simple. And I therefore said, well, what if it is rooted in history? And we can cut through all the levels of legend and myth and find the historical facts.
Yeah, I think that's a great starting point of inquiry. And one other thing I want to ask you before jumping into the Nabataeans and your take on who they were. The tradition that we have now of the three wise men, of course, at Christmas pageants where an 8 or 10 year old will put on their big robes. I think I was one of those once. I can't remember what I was in a passion, or a shepherd. Someone in the background who doesn't say anything, so probably not a Magi. But so they come with their three robes, bearing gold, myrrh, and frankincense, and with, like you said, this biblical critical criticism. Who knows? I mean, maybe it's sort of a pushback against what they think of this sort of traditional accoutrement of the holidays. It's almost silly to think that that's exactly how it took, because they're almost going against the common man or woman who thought it looked exactly like that 2000 years ago. But my question is, this understanding that we see in Christmas pageants, you've written elsewhere that that's not exactly how it's described in the biblical account. So where did this come from? Where did the, you know, three wise men from Persia, from Orient, we three kings of Orient are, where does that all come from?
Well, this is really, really interesting, because what happened was Early Christians, of course, were in Judea. They were in Jerusalem and southern Judea. But soon after the death of Christ, they began to be persecuted by the other Jews. And so they began to leave Judea, Jerusalem and southern Judea. That's recorded in the Acts of the Apostles. You might remember the Apostle Paul was actually rounding them up, putting them in jail, and they were being martyred. It got even worse at 70 AD when the Romans came in and destroyed Jerusalem. At that point, of course, all the Jews, including the Jewish Christians, were dispersed. And that meant that the center of gravity for the early Christian church by the late first century and early second century moved to the north and to the west. So Christianity started to put down its roots in Syria, Armenia, what is present-day Turkey, Greece, and Italy. Therefore, as Christianity moved to the north and west, and the churches were established there, they encountered the religion of Manichaeism. Manichaeism was from a Persian prophet named Mani, who was the son of Jewish parents who had converted to Christianity, but he was also very influenced by Zoroastrianism, the native religion of Persia. And at the same time, there were lots of Gnostic sects which were active in the same area. The Gnosticism was basically like New Age religion today. Lots of fanciful theories about angels and demons and the way the world was created and spirits and so forth. And Manichaeism was influenced by that. This is very popular in the area of Persia, Armenia, Turkey, and Syria. And various apocryphal writings in the second and third century came up, which mingled Zoroastrianism, Gnosticism, Christianity, and Jewish esotericism. So what happened was these magi from Persia, they became the poster boys for this kind of new religion. This was fantastic to them, that these astrologer, shaman priests from mysterious Persia saw a magical star and traveled through the desert to visit the Christ child. And so there are various what are called infancy narratives. The Syriac, the Arabic infancy narrative, and various other apocryphal writings from the second and third century, which took the Magi story and added in an awful lot of the legendary and mythological elements we now attach to it. And so this is where we have, by around the fourth or fifth century, the three wise men were being called kings. They were given names. They came from Persia, Africa, India, China. Who knows? But the different writings place them all over the place. And there's about six or seven different versions of their names. And all of this then came into the Christianity of Turkey, Greece, and southern Italy, and then became part of the medieval tradition, which we still celebrate today.
Okay. So there is something to deconstructing that element of the story. And so for you, let's jump into the Nabataeans and what you've tried to find with the story. So who are the Nabataeans and how do you think that they've connected to the real nativity story?
Again, when I dug into the history of the Nabataeans, it just got interestinger and interestinger. You know what I mean? The Nabataeans are this mysterious civilization who didn't leave any written record of their history. And this is a mystery to the historians. Therefore, we have to piece together from graffiti, archaeological finds, a few scraps of writing about the Nabataeans, which are extant in contemporary historians, Greek and Roman historians. But there's very little to go by. But the more you piece together the history, the more interesting it becomes. So first of all, if we go back to the 6th century BC, Arabia is occupied by various different nomadic tribes, the Edomites, the Nebaioth, and various others. And all of these, most of these nomadic tribes in the Arabian Peninsula trace their roots back to Abraham. In one way or other, they say that they are descended from Abraham, maybe from their descendants of his son Isaac or descendants from his illegitimate son Ishmael. And so they have already got a very ancient type of Hebrew Abrahamic type religion. They've also, this is where the Jews also wandered on their way to Cana, to the Promised Land. So this is all deeply Abrahamic and Jewish in its ancestry. And then in 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, the Neo-Babylonian monarch from the area of Persia, which is present-day Iraq, invades northern Arabia and then goes on and conquers Jerusalem and destroys Jerusalem, and the Jews are dispersed. Now, we talk about this, call it the exile. Mm-hmm. We think the Jews were exiled to Babylon. An awful lot of the Jews also escaped into northern Arabia. So they joined in with these Arabian tribes that were already there. The third element is that the Babylonians themselves occupied Arabia. King Nabonidus was the last of the Neo-Babylonian kings. He was very interested in Judaism. And so you have these three elements, the Arabian Abrahamic tribes, the Jews in exile, and then the Neo-Babylonians. And the Babylonians brought the Magi traditions of astrology, esoteric religion, science, astronomy, mathematics. All these developing arts and sciences and religion came in with the Babylonian Magi into northern Arabia. And these three factors contributed to the rise of the Nabataean civilization. So that 500 years later, the time of the birth of Christ, you find this thriving, fabulously wealthy civilization there in northern Arabia.
Now, I love being able to discover more about different people, places, and times, and a big reason why I do this podcast. And with the Great Courses Plus, I'm able to do that. I can spend hours watching and listening to these fascinating lectures, learning from award-winning experts about absolutely anything. History, politics, the American Revolution, World War II, military strategy, life in the ancient world, hobbies like foreign languages, sports, photography, cooking, and basically anything else due to the unlimited access to thousands of topics. In the theme of today's episode, I recommend checking out the Great Courses Plus's fascinating course on the historical Jesus. This is taught by Professor Bart Ehrman about what different scholars have to say about the life of the most significant figure in the history of Western civilization. You can watch this course from any TV, laptop, or smartphone, or you can listen along on the Great Courses Plus app. Now is a wonderful time to start enjoying the Great Courses Plus. You can sign up today, and as one of my listeners, you'll get a free month to watch and listen to any of their lectures. All you have to do is go to my special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/unplugged. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/unplugged. And you can start your free month today if you go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/unplugged. What you just described there is a really good description also of population movements, how people move around, and the dispersal of the Jewish people after exile, part of what gets them into places like Ethiopia. So in Israel, you'll see people that, for all intents and purposes, look African, but are fighting in the Israeli army. And my study is Middle Eastern history. And when I look at accounts of the rise of Islam, it'll mention Jewish people all throughout Arabia, in down into the peninsula where Mecca and Medina are. And I think, how did they get down there? This really,
there are records that there were Jewish settlements and colonies right down in what is now Yemen, which was the kingdom of Saba, and also that they were very, very popular. They were very populous in the in Medina, as you say, but also in the oasis town of Tema. King Nabonidus from Babylon actually settled in Tema for 10 years and was known to have Jewish mercenaries and Jewish prophets there. One writer actually thinks that the second part of the prophet Isaiah was written from Tema, from a Jewish colony in Arabia.
Did they mostly retain their Jewish identity and religion living here, or did it become something like the Samaritans, where it's not quite the Orthodox practice?
There were they retained what the British scholar Margaret Barker calls a first temple Judaism. This was a simpler Judaism based more in the Abrahamic religion of faith than the later second temple Judaism, which was much more based in the Mosaic law. And that was a sort of a Judaism which would have been in Jerusalem and Israel at the time of Christ's life. So the ones who escaped into Arabia would have mingled with the Abrahamic tribes who were already there and found a very congenial environment. There are elements of the Nabataean religion, for instance, which are connect very well with Judaism. For instance, they have a prohibition of idols, and they had, instead of an idol, they would have a square block of stone, of rock, which was called a Betel. And of course, that connects with the story in the Old Testament of Jacob, who saw the angels going up and down on the stairway to heaven, and he set up a rock in that place and called it Bethel. And so there's all sorts of connections like that, which are fascinating.
And just geography-wise, so the Nabataeans, once they sort of coalesce as a people, as you described, we're talking, so this would be south of Israel in modern nation-state terminology. About what countries would it correspond to?
It's really, nowadays, it's the country of Jordan, and Jordan and northwest Saudi Arabia.
Okay, and they're moving around. You said they were traders, and they're going around mm-hmm. a lot in those areas.
Yeah, now the trading aspect is fascinating because they were fabulously wealthy because they controlled the trade routes across the Arabian Peninsula, basically coming from the port of Yemen up across to the north and to the west across the Arabian Peninsula. Petra was a crossroads, and from Petra you continued west across Judea to the port of Gaza, where you went, where you unloaded your camels on ships across the Mediterranean to the rest of the empire. But also there was another trade route which went from Egypt in the south, north to Damascus, and then on up through Syria, and it also went through Petra. So Petra was the crossroads of these two trade routes.
And that's this time in history. I think this is after the Hellenic or Hellenistic age, when there's this whole new level of east-west integration, and carrying things overland is hard. I mean, you really have to have a lot of draft and pack animals. So if you can do this, there's a lot of money to be had. So they're kind of like, I don't know if this is a good comparison, but like the Rothschilds of the ancient world.
Well, I think they were more like the UPS. Of the
oh, yeah, that's
world.
Better. Right.
They have a logistics system across the desert, which was incredible. And the way they were able to monopolize and control it all, of course, was through water. They had a very sophisticated hydraulics system where they engineered the control and the flow of water. They built these wonderful funnel-like systems in the earth, which caught the rainwater and funneled it down into underground cisterns, and then they covered it up and kept them secret. So, for instance, whenever the military tried to take over the Nabataeans, they retreated further into the desert to their various secret water cisterns and let their enemies die of thirst, basically. And when they were weakened and starving, they would then turn around and ride down with their camels and attack.
Wow! Yeah, and that's why empires really never bothered trying to conquer Arabia, because if you have an army, a desert is the worst place to be if you want to control it.
Yeah, and one of the first military exploits which is recorded was one of Alexander the Great's generals, Antigonus the One-Eyed, was told to go in and conquer the Nabataeans, and he marched in with his army, and that's exactly what happened. They pulled back and retreated to their high places and to their secret cisterns, and drew them further and further into the desert and then turned on them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a theme that comes up with chronicles about the rise of Islam, that part of what they could take advantage of military strategy is that they're fighting Byzantines that have to water their horses or pack animals. And if you're more used to arid climates and can just retreat back, then you've got a whole terrain advantage. So Nabataean traders, are they, first of all, are they going about by caravans with all their camels that they're packing on? And I guess I'll just ask that first. How do they transport all of these trade items?
Yeah, there's records right back through to the Assyrian civilization which I'm rough on my dates here, but we're talking about probably the 7th and 8th centuries BC. There's records of the Assyrian kings demanding tribute gifts of hundreds of camels from the Arabian tribes. This is pre-Nabataean days. So, but obviously, right back then, they were famous for taming camels, breeding camels, trading with camels, and using camels as pack animals across the desert.
And what kind of things would they typically trade in these different cities that they traveled between?
Oh, it was, it was just incredible. They were taking silk and spices from glass and pottery and all sorts of things from India and China, which had come across the Indian Ocean to the port of Yemen. And this is the most important thing for the Magi. Gold, frankincense, and myrrh were their cash crops. Frankincense and myrrh are both taken from the gum of bushes that only grow in the Arabian Peninsula and East Africa. And so they had a monopoly on frankincense and myrrh, but also Arabia was famous in the ancient times for gold mines. You probably heard of the gold mines of Solomon.
Right.
Well, archaeologists have found these in northern Arabia, the remains of these fantastic gold mines, which were there, and also in present-day Somalia. They've discovered gold mines from the 8th century from the Queen of Sheba. And so gold, frankincense, and myrrh were basically the cash crops of the Nabataeans, but they were also trading goods from India and China, as I said. And then on the return journey, they were bringing bitumen from the Dead Sea. They were bringing damask from Damascus. They were bringing gauze from Gaza. They were bringing pearls. They were bringing all sorts of riches from the West back across the desert to go back on those boats to India and China.
I should I'll definitely include a map with these show notes so people listening can see what we're talking about. But I've read about that in historical accounts. This is more of a factoid question I have, but I'm always curious about these things. The Gulf of Yemen is, a major trade point going all the way back to the very ancient world. Why didn't ships just go up the Gulf of Suez all the way up to the Sinai Peninsula? Because traveling by ship has always been much cheaper than traveling over land. Traveling over land is very difficult, very expensive. And like you said, part of why Nabataeans could be rich because they could monopolize this difficult thing of carrying thousands of pounds over the desert, which carrying thousands of pounds over the ship is much easier. So why didn't ships just go all the way up?
Well, the answer is they did. The Nabataeans also had shipping routes that were going up the Red Sea and Suez and so forth. But the problem was it was more vulnerable because the Egyptians had ships out there as well, and they were pirating each other. Mm. A bit like the Spanish and the English in the 16th century.
Pirates.
Yeah, and so basically the Nabataeans found that their trade routes across the desert were actually more secure. In addition to the secret cisterns I spoke about, their routes followed mountaintops and down into narrow wadi and valleys so that they were actually very difficult to attack by bandits because of their not only the secret cisterns, but also their the way they actually wended through the desert. And the ships, in comparison, were subject to shipwreck. They were subject to stormy weather. They were also subject to pirates. So it was, although they did have shipping, the camel caravans were more controllable and more secure.
And if you're a highwayman, you're probably not able to hang out in the desert for weeks on end waiting for a caravan. And if you do, you probably can't attack a whole caravan. That's a good safety measure.
I think also the simple economic factor is, I haven't looked into this too much, but I believe that the shippers were not Nabataeans. And so you have an extra middleman there. And if you can cut out that middleman by using your own camels, your profit margins increase.
Yeah, I could probably ask questions on this all day. I'm reading a book now called Travel in the Ancient World. And this whole issue of how people got around is just fascinating because, like you said, it's dangerous. There's pirates at sea, there's bandits on land. And we don't appreciate that in the modern world. And the people who are able to be traders are both entrepreneurial, but also quite hardy to be able to handle this. So they're just fascinating people. And so this civilization that is accumulating wealth by trade, like you said, they're UPS. They're also sort of an Amazon at this time offering these goods. Well, one more thing before I ask you about how this gets us to the nativity story. Okay, frankincense and myrrh. I might be exposing my ignorance here, but you said they were cash crops. What else were they used for? We've heard these terms forever, but why would someone have frankincense and myrrh back then?
Okay, myrrh would be, first of all, they were very portable because they were taken from dried resin from a tree. Once it dried out, it was like transporting little rocks or sand. So it was something which was not, it was not perishable. And once you got the myrrh, you would grind it up into a fine powder and add oils to make very rich perfumes, but also it was used for various medicinal purposes. So it was very valued in the ancient world for both perfume and medicinal purposes, and also for anointing the dead. Obviously, to take care of the smell, the corpse would be anointed. Also, it was a bit of an analgesic. Jesus was given myrrh mixed with wine when he was on the cross to deaden the pain. Mm. So it had medicinal and perfume purposes. The frankincense was burned as an act of worship in virtually every pagan temple every day. And for funerals, and they consumed huge amounts of frankincense in the religions right across Greece, Rome, Egypt, Persia, right across the ancient world. And so if your religious duty was that you had to make an offering to the gods, you would go and burn a spoonful of incense. And the richer you were, the more incense you wanted to offer. So there's records, for instance, of tons of incense being burnt in the various temples all day long across the ancient world.
Okay, yeah, you're just saying that brings to mind triggers a lot of things of the symbolism of these gifts in the nativity story. Mm-hmm. So now, bringing all this together, Nabataeans are this trading civilization. How do you see them in the nativity story? What would cause Nabataeans who are in Jordan to come up to Israel, to come up to Bethlehem during his birth, or how does this all fit together from what you've seen?
Okay, this is where the politics gets really interesting. And so you've got Herod the Great, who is a vassal king of the Romans. And Caesar Augustus, Octavian Caesar, is the emperor at the time. And his vassal king in Judea is Herod. Herod is a very shrewd political survivor. He survived through basically cruelty, murder, suspicion, and being pretty smart. And his neighbor is King Aretas IV, the Nabataean king. And Herod is at the end of his reign. He's an old man. He's still paranoid that someone's going to try to take his throne. Aretas IV has just kind of usurped the throne of the Nabataeans and sort of stepped in when Obidas III, his predecessor, was poisoned by one of his rivals. Now, Caesar Augustus is not real happy that Aretas IV has stepped onto the throne without his permission. Furthermore, because of some political intrigues, Herod had also fallen out of the good graces of Caesar Augustus. So right around 7 BC, Aretas IV and Herod the Great send an emissary to Caesar Augustus in Rome to try to get back into his good books. And they succeed, and Caesar Augustus is now feeling kindly towards Herod, but he's still feeling a bit edgy towards Aretas IV and still a bit cross with Aretas IV. So Aretas IV in 6 BC has every motivation to send a diplomatic entourage to the court of Herod the Great once he discerns that a new heir to the king of the Jews has been born. His court advisors would have been astrologers, would have been magi in the Babylonian and Jewish wise man tradition. And so when they told him that the stars said that the newborn king of the Jews was born, Aretas says, I know, it would be very good to send a diplomatic entourage to Herod's court and congratulate him on the birth of his new grandson and to give him these gifts and to sort of build bridges. Furthermore, when Augustus got friendly with Herod again, he gave the port of Gaza back to Herod. And so Aretas, to get his goods across southern Judea to Gaza, has got to go through all of Herod's checkpoints, custom border controls, and get to the port of Gaza in order to ship his, keep his trade lines open. So therefore, the wise men, in my theory, were courtiers from the from the court of Aretas IV in Petra in Nabatea, and they're going to the court of King Herod to give him diplomatic gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh from their country to his country to congratulate him on the birth of his grandson and his heir. Of course, they get there, and he says, "What heir? What grandson?" And suddenly the story takes a turn, and they're kind of like, help. And so that's how the story continues.
Wow. Okay. So this is, so you see it as there was a political element they come into, and it's not as though they knew exactly how the events were going to unfold, which,
Yeah. And this is the point that's always been missing in the typical tale of the Magi story. What motivated these men to make this journey? And religious believers say, oh, it's because they had a spiritual longing to go and find the newborn, son of God. Probably not. They might have had a spiritual dimension to it, and I think they did because of the history of the Nabataeans and how much religion and politics were intertwined. But there was also an economic and political dimension.
Right. I think I'm. This account is in Matthew. Is that correct? Mostly with the Magi.
Yes.
Okay. So I don't, it's not fresh in my mind, but if my memory serves me correctly, a lot of what people would say about the nativity story, they're probably imputing things that the text itself wouldn't say. Is that correct? That they,
completely. The idea of the wise men going on a long journey across the desert and following a magical star, Matthew doesn't say that. He doesn't say they went on a long journey. He doesn't say they traveled across the desert. And he doesn't say that the star moved in front of them as they went. When you read his simple language, they say, we saw his star in the east, and we came to worship him. That means that, according to my reading, they saw some sort of astrological signs where they were in Petra in Nabatea. And by the way, there's lots of evidence that the Nabataeans were actual stargazers and astrologers. And they took that sign and set off for Jerusalem.
Hmm. Okay. And that could be any number of things. That, what do you think that astrological event could have been based on what they, obviously they took it seriously as an auspicious sign. What do you think that would have been?
Well, there's four different theories. One is that it was some kind of a miraculous sign from heaven, a star that moved across the night sky and guided them. I don't dismiss that because I believe in miracles, but I don't think that's likely. We always look for the natural explanation first. The second explanation would be that it is some kind of an astronomical event, like an asteroid or a comet or some kind of an unusual astronomical event which took place. But then we have to ask ourselves, why would that necessarily cause them to go on this journey, to find the king of the Jews? The third option is much more likely, that they were astrologers. And we know that the astrology of the ancient world, using the zodiac, they were able to predict future events. And also, different constellations were associated in the ancient astrological tables with certain countries. Certain planets were associated with certain with royalty, for instance. So there's lots of theories out there, but the most interesting one was by Michael Molnar, a retired astronomer, who believes that there was a conjunction of planets, and there was an astrological sign with the planet Jupiter, which is the royal sign in the constellation Aries, and that they read the royal sign of Jupiter in Aries, which was associated with the Jews, and said, aha, a new king of the Jews will be born. The fourth theory is that it's that combined with some kind of astronomical thing like a comet or something. My own view is that they were stargazers, and that the fourth theory is that there were probably numerous things they saw in the star charts, which made them draw that conclusion.
That's really fascinating, because it takes people who were just really going about their business, in this case, a political mission, and then sort of falling into something they didn't expect. But it humanizes the story in a way that I think the way a lot of pastors tell it doesn't, where they have the versions I've heard of it in the past where they were cognizant of the prophecies of the Messiah and put them together and came for that reason. Whereas here they happen into it. But I mean, a lot of people in scriptural tradition sort of happen into, you know, situations encountering the Almighty. So that's, yeah, really fascinating.
Yeah, but that's right, Scott. But these things are not divorced from one another.
Right.
It's possible to have a political and economic motivation while still being aware of the prophecies. And my study of the Nabataeans shows that, first of all, the key prophecies were in the prophet Isaiah, which probably originated from the Nabataean civilization. Hmm. So it was written by Jews in northern Arabia, where they already were. So they would have known those prophecies, but they were also influenced by Zoroastrianism, the Persian religion, which also had prophecies about a star and about a Messiah figure, which would arise. And so, they would have known those prophecies and that would have fit in with the astrology they were looking at. So it's not separated from the political and economic realities.
When this group comes and when we get into the nativity story itself, I know that I think it never mentions in the Matthew account that there are three wise men. So maybe they're, I don't think we know the number, but what kind of group do you think would have been showing up? What would have looked like? Would it have been a few people, a lot of people, high ranking delegates, low ranking? What's your take on who showed up there?
I don't know. We're in the realm of speculation. There is an interesting detail from about 60 AD where the king of Armenia travels to pay homage to Nero in Rome. And he travels with some magi, interestingly enough, from Armenia. And he travels with a whole entourage of, military, wise men, court officials, and the king himself going to pay tribute and homage to Nero. And so I guess that's a kind of contemporary account which we could speculate or envision King Aretas IV sending an entourage to King Herod. I would speculate and say that probably there were a number of wise men or magi who came, and that they had a small military group with them. That's my speculation.
It also explains some things where in the traditional account, the We Three Kings of Orient are, if that were actually true, if there are these people from Persia, number one, they wouldn't have spoke a common language with Mary and Joseph because Persian speakers.
They would.
They would have known Aramaic.
Aramaic was common right back through the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries BC in Persia. It was the lingua franca for the entire ancient world. So, they would have known Aramaic. But the thing about where they came from also is an important piece of evidence. Right when Matthew says that wise men came from the east. Now, if you remember, I said that Christianity's center of gravity had shifted north and west to Armenia, Turkey, Greece, and Italy. Well, if you're there, then the east is Persia and India. Mm. But Matthew's gospel was written to the Judean Christians in the early days in Jerusalem and Judea. They were Jews, and they were still in Judea. Now, for them, the east is Arabia. And biblical scholar Tony Maloof has written a terrific book showing how all through the Old Testament, the Jews referred to the east, to Arabia as the east, kind of like we would say, he's from the south. And we know that means Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia. When they said the east, that was Arabia. So Matthew's word there, wise men came from the east, means Arabia. And the earliest witnesses to the tradition put the wise men from Arabia. It's only when the Gnostic traditions grew up in the 2nd and 3rd centuries and Christianity shifted north and west that the east started to mean Persia.
Right. So that explains a lot more where they're closer in distance, probably closer in culture. I'm talking about Mary and Joseph and the Magi, closer in language.
Yeah.
A lot of things. There, I believe in the Cologne Cathedral in Germany, there are relics of the wise men. And
yes.
I know you said that there's a lot of the story that gets into speculation just because of lack of sources. But so would they have ridden camels? I mean, would the legendary aspects of it, how much of this is plausible in the relics in Cologne? Where do you think that comes from?
No, relics in Cologne is a very late tradition from like the 4th to the 5th century, and even later, where the legend was that Queen Helena, the Empress Helena, the mother of Constantine, who did actually discover a lot of authentic relics in Jerusalem, that she also discovered the tombs of the wise men in Persia and brought their bones back. There's no really earlier evidence than that to this legend. But once it sort of got onto the relic trail through the Middle Ages, they found their way to Cologne Cathedral. So I think I like when relics are authentic, but I think those ones are not for all the reasons that I've laid out. But about camels, now this is also interesting. We all know about Arabian horses. And it was during the Greek influence of the Nabataeans in the 2nd and 3rd centuries BC that the Nabataeans started to develop and breed horses as well as camels. And there's records of them donating horses to Pompey's military campaign and Julius Caesar's military campaigns and developing quite a quick quick response force of their military on horseback, a cavalry. By the time of Jesus' birth, the Nabataean noblemen who were making their way from Petra to Jerusalem almost certainly would have ridden on horses. That was the prestige means of transportation. The camels had become pack horses, pack animals. And so I'm afraid wise men on camels is probably not accurate. And Matthew doesn't talk about camels at all, you see. So if they had camels, they would have been pack animals.
Right. They're sort of the long haul freight truck of the Middle East. I mean, they can haul incredible amounts of weight, but maybe not the most dignified thing to go on.
Yeah, exactly. And also the trip from Petra to Jerusalem is about 300 miles. On established roads, which they would have known from their travels, they wouldn't have needed camels to make that journey. It was through a fairly populated area across into southern Judea, then up north to Jerusalem, with plenty of stopping places, and you wouldn't have needed the pack animals to make that journey.
There's also the tradition that the names of these three were Balthazar, Melchor, I think it's pronounced, and Caspar. Where does that come from? Is that also, I'm guessing, a later legend that comes about?
Yeah, around the 4th and the 5th century when these Gnostic writings, apocryphal gospels, were being developed. Well, between the 2nd and 4th centuries, yes, they started giving them names and started saying that they were kings and starting saying they came from India, Persia, Africa, and even mythical lands of the East. There's one document called the Revelation of the Magi, which is this great long 8th century document in which says they came from a mythical land in the mountains, and it's complete myth. And that's when the names came up. And there's about, I think about maybe half a dozen different versions of their names, depending on the countries that the writings came from.
Up in some mountain hanging out with Prester John. That's another guy.
Prester John. Yep. Prester John comes into it as well. That some think that, you know, that the Magi had links with him.
Yeah. I'll have to do a whole episode of him too. He's an interesting fellow and legend. Mm-hmm. Something that you mentioned, in your notes, just giving me some scope on this area that I thought's fascinating and I'd love to hear, is you say Anthony and Cleopatra fit into this story. So how did they fit into this story?
Well, that goes back to the politics of the time. Anthony and, well, basically, if you remember your Roman history, Julius Caesar comes in and invades Rome, and Pompey flees and is killed in Egypt. Anthony and Octavian, then Julius Caesar's, after his assassination, Octavian and Anthony are, and then the assassins of Julius Caesar are all vying for power. And finally, it's Anthony in the has the eastern part of the empire, and Octavian's in Rome with the western part of the empire. And of course, they're starting to gear up for the great battle of Actium. And Herod is stuck in the middle. Okay, he's in Jerusalem. Anthony's with Cleopatra in the south, and Octavian is in Rome. And Cleopatra would like Anthony to give her the territories of Judea and Nabatea, which once belonged to the Egyptian Empire. So she has designs on Herod's kingdom and on the Nabatean kingdom. Meantime, Anthony's gearing up for war against Octavian, and naturally, Herod's in the middle saying, which one of these am I going to support? My allegiance is to Anthony because my territory falls under his suzerainty. But if Octavian wins, I'm going to be in hot water. So Herod does a very shrewd thing. He sort of does a get out by declaring war on the Nabataeans. And he goes and invades the Nabataeans, so he can therefore say to both Anthony and Octavian, "I'm sorry, guys, I don't have any armies to be able to support your worthy cause. I'm engaged on the Eastern Front." So he therefore uses the opportunity to get some extra territory, put the Nabataeans in line, and defend his borders. And then when it all blows over and Octavian emerges as the winner, Herod can go to Octavian and say, "Of course I was always on your side, my lord. Of course, if only I had been able to support you with my armies, but I was unfortunately occupied elsewhere." So that's where Anthony and Cleopatra fit in.
Wow. So I don't know. This is absolute speculation, but some of the people who, let's say they were at the nativity, maybe could have had some connection with Anthony and Cleopatra. I don't know if they were operating on both sides here.
Well, yeah. I mean, because Cleopatra had her designs on the Nabatean kingdom as well. And so if the wise men were old men, they would have remembered all of those politics and would have been very aware of Anthony and Cleopatra and everything that happened.
I think you might have a historical first there. If you connect those two, that's a degree of separation that's pretty interesting. So
it's fascinating, isn't it? The way it all connects.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, we always learn about these things in isolation, but never fit all the pieces together. So Father, thank you for all this information. Now, I always like to ask this of guests. You're working on a book on this topic, and this book comes out this Advent in 2017. Is that correct?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Comes out the fall of 2017.
Mm-hmm. Now, for somebody like you who writes a whole book, obviously you had to dig into this subject really far, really deeply. And because you dug in so deeply, what would you say are the one or two things that you really came away with from this research project that this is the thing that you always like to share with people after digging so deeply into this subject?
I think where we started is actually one of the things which interests me the most, that the modern scholars, first of all, when I did this research, I kept waiting to find the person who'd already written this book, and nobody has. And that's because the most of the modern biblical scholars, as I said, dismiss the Magi story as being unhistorical. Therefore, they never actually did their homework and dug into whether it might have been. It was like the assumption was, oh, yeah, that's just a fairy tale. And furthermore, biblical scholars have told me that it's almost kind of like your calling card within the realm of New Testament scholarship that you're not allowed to believe that there's any historical basis to the Magi story. In other words, to have a good reputation within those academic circles, you really mustn't question that orthodoxy. But I'm not a New Testament scholar, so I don't have any reputation to maintain. And so, therefore, any question that it was historical was usually dismissed with, "Oh well, yes, if they were historical, they were Persian shaman." From present day Iraq, but we'll just move on now. And so that's one of the things that interests me, that sort of blind spot that a lot of scholars and historians had about this. Therefore, the other thing which I really became interested in is the the fascinating mix of cultures in this Nabataean civilization. As a trading culture, crisscrossing across the Arabian Peninsula from India, China, Rome, Greece, Egypt, Persia, Babylon, all these great civilizations. It's right there in the center of all of these different cultural and historical sort of currents, and they're a result of it. Therefore, the Nabataeans are this kind of fantastic melting pot of ancient civilizations, which I just found very intriguing.
They are fascinating and overlooked a lot, but there's a lot to gain in that story. And like something that you said, I'd resonate with that as a person who finished his PhD in history, that there's of course a lot of biases and groupthink in academia that sometimes people will just shut the door because of the crippling pressure to get tenure or get research grants. So sometimes I really do think it takes someone from the outside who doesn't have a dog in the fight to look into things. So yeah, I think it's a very good angle you've gone out.
I'm the other thing which is involved here, which doesn't have to do with my book really, is also, the kind of snobbery that exists within academia towards any book which is popularly written. Mm-hmm. My book is popularly written. You know, it has subheadings and it has some catchy title headlines and so forth, because I want a lot of people to read it, and I want it to, because it's really genuinely interesting. But of course, a lot of the academics will sort of turn up their nose. Oh, it's a popular book. You know, it's it's only 60,000 words rather than 160,000 words for a doctoral thesis. With respect, if you have a PhD in history.
Oh, no, it's larded out so heavily to suit the biases of three or four different people on your committee. So, ugh.
Well, there you go. And so therefore, I kind of hope that the book will attract some attention, and maybe get people to question their biases a little bit, both in New Testament scholarship and in history, because I haven't found a lot of historians who were willing to put the two together either. It seems like you have experts in biblical history and in New Testament scholarship, and then you have those who are very interested in political and economic history of the time, but there are very few that seem to be putting the two together. And I think it's fascinating to see how they work together.
I agree. I think it's very interesting. And when we get closer to the launch date, we'll have to have you back on in some capacity because I would love more to discuss these things. And until then, you're very active online. And if people want to see other things that you've written and articles or whatnot, where is the best place to find you online?
Well, I have a website, dwightlongenecker.com. And, as we move forward to the book launch, I'll be writing more about New Testament scholarship and the Magi and so forth. At the moment, I'm a Catholic priest, so I write a lot of religious stuff. But they're welcome to come and search and engage in conversation.
Right, definitely keeping busy. Well, Father Longenecker, thank you very much, and really appreciate you coming on. And we'll have links to all these things in this episode. And yeah, really appreciate your time.
Happy to be with you.
So that is our interview. I really don't have anything else to add after it. Again, go to historyonthenet, where you can find the show notes for this podcast episode. Find out more of what Father Longenecker has written. Really fascinating stuff. The book will come out at the end of this year, and I'll make sure to have links for it there. Until then, see you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast, so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.